This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at MOFAD.org.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Valentine's Day. Whether it's your favorite day of the season or you avoid it like the plague, there's no debating it's a big day for the world of food and hospitality.
Valentine's Day is what we refer to in the industry as a blackout day.
I don't feel that my manlyhood is threatened when I order a glass of rosé or, God forbid, a rosé champagne.
It's an old Jamaican drink from way back, and we just decided to bring it back into existence. It's a drink that the men, they believe it really does wonders.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coralie. Joining us today from Manchester is food sociologist Alan Ward. Author of over 10 books, Alan's research explores the intersection of food scholarship and sociology. We'll be discussing his thoughts and theories on the sociology of food consumption as found in his books, Eating Out and The Practice of Eating. Thank you so much for joining me today, Alan.
Hello. Nice to be with you.
So I actually want to talk about your email signature. It says you're the professorial fellow of the Sustainable Consumption Institute. What exactly does sustainable consumption mean?
Sustainable consumption is formulated in relation to environmental problems and climate change. And one issue would be the extent to which the ways in which we currently consume, the Western world, the whole world, is sustainable over a long period of time, given the changes in the environment. And that raises issues of social sustainability as well as natural resources. Mm-hmm. So food is a very interesting kind of issue, given that it's absorbs lots of such resources. So the Institute is interested in the way in which people consume and some of the implications for environmental change.
Mm-hmm. So we actually think a lot on the show, I feel like a broken record sometimes, about whether our choices or tastes are both deliberate and our own. And do you think that this is the case? And how does your take inform what and how you approach in your research?
Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly some approaches are very deliberative. People think about what they're doing, and that's fine. But they very often, I think, exaggerate the extent of their choice because of the way in which the world is set for them. So I've increasingly come to the view that people behave in relatively routine and habitual kinds of ways, and they behave in the same sorts of ways as the people around them and the people like them, so that even though one could in principle always choose something different, something radically different, most of the time what people actually consume, the foods they choose, the places they go to, are relatively predictable and patterned. So there's a pattern to the way in which groups of people with the same characteristics behave, and that suggests that they're not exercising, in a sense, radical free choice.
Yeah, I actually, I've also mentioned this on the show before, but the past month or so I've been obsessed with the idea of making this perfect blood orange olive oil cake. And then I realized I was getting a lot of ads from Amazon and Whole Foods on blood oranges and olive oil. And I started to think, is this a decision that I made of my own, or is this something that's been manufactured in me? And so why do you think this pattern exists among humans, I guess, as a society?
I don't think it's so much among humans as amongst kind of particular societies at particular points in time. Mm. I mean, clearly the capacity for that form of communication and the impact of commercial communication, which is your adverts for your olive oil and blood oranges, is a feature of the last 20 years maybe, or possibly 50 years. So the way in which our societies, sorry, Western societies of the moment kind of work, that sort of information, you don't have to act on that information, but that sort of information will be readily available to lots of people. And, of course, you will have been targeted because you're a particular potential kind of consumer. So it's the companies and the advertisers know quite a lot about the way in which we behave and we consume, and they try to match the things that they have to sell to the patterns of behavior of people who might buy their products. So I think that's the explanation for your particular example.
Right, yeah, I was going to ask, what does exactly Whole Foods or Amazon gain from me buying specifically blood oranges or olive oil? Does it just happen to be an object to consume?
No, I think Amazon gets the advertising revenue, does it not?
Mm-hmm.
I'm no expert on that. I don't think Amazon probably cares whether you like blood oranges or pasta.
Mm-hmm.
As far as Amazon's concerned, it's the intermediary between a company wanting to sell something and a potential kind of market amongst consumers.
Mm-hmm. So let's take a bit of a step back. Can you give some context as to the scholarship that exists already on consumption, whether food or not, and our understanding of pleasure?
Yeah. I mean, consumption was not something that academics studied very carefully until about 50 years ago, and it arose along with the growth of mass consumption as a kind of feature of advanced industrial societies at the time. Initially, people were interested in who could sell what to whom. So market research was an important form of knowledge from the 1950s, and still is, of course. Sociologists got interested in it when they started to think that kind of culture and the way in which consumption might affect culture. So from the basically 1970s, 1980s, people started to think about the way in which people used consumption to express their personal identity or the group that they belong to, their sense of identity. And that generated a lot of research about how people might use consumption. At the same time, there was a kind of critical account, there were a lot of critical accounts, actually, which suggested that consumption was not necessarily a benevolent and beneficial process throughout, and that people, social groups, used consumption in order to express their kind of social status, social superiority, perhaps. So the ways in which groups of people consume has a symbolic significance in relation to social hierarchy. So there's quite a lot of literature in that vein. And in the past 10, 15 years, people have oscillated backwards and forwards, I think, between seeing consumption as an expression of self and group identity and an expression of power and authority and hierarchy in consumer cultures. So people can use their cultural knowledge, their cultural experience as a strategic way of managing kind of social relationships to their benefit and, in that sense, to other people's detriment.
Right. This makes me kind of think of Walter Benjamin and how he kind of warned of our passive consumption of, I think, film or TV, and how there's like what we were talking about earlier. There's this illusion of choice, what we decide to consume, but there's also this very passive way of consuming whatever it is we decide to choose or we ever decide to consume. So when and why would you advise to actually take consumption seriously as a field of study?
I mean, the critique of it being passive is one that's now slightly old. I mean, the response to... there is an account of consumption whereby people are kind of manipulated, brainwashed, and they simply accept what's given to them. A perfectly reasonable response to that is that if you look at what people actually do, they're more creative, they resist, they take things into their own hands as a way of using consumption for their own purposes. So I don't think they're the kind of dupes or fools that some accounts might suggest. So I think consumption is very multifaceted, multi-sided. There are lots of different aspects to it, but in recent decades, people have become much more aware of the positive benefits of consumption. I mean, you can say, express identity, you can enjoy yourself, you can use the things that we consume for educational purposes, for recreational purposes. It often makes people happy. It's consumption is part of fun. So there was a view of consumption that it really was rather bad for us. It can't be eliminated. So, and particularly food consumption. But the positive aspects of consumption, I think, were underestimated until about 25 years ago. And Benjamin obviously is from a slightly earlier generation in that regard.
And so what are the positives? You mentioned creativity, but what else?
Creativity, fun, and actually political resistance. Some people consume in ways, I think, of subcultures and expressing their discontent with the world. Mm-hmm. It encourages an aesthetic way of thinking, so people start to think about the things in their everyday life as if in terms of whether they're beautiful, valuable, or whatever, rather than just taking them for granted. And of course, they're practically useful. They make us comfortable. Various kind of activities of consumption broaden our horizons and increase our experiences. Mm-hmm. So it's not all bad.
Yeah. So I'm going to you bring up Joanna Finkelstein's work, which is called Dining Out, and that was also published in a slightly earlier generation, maybe closer to Benjamin, which had very similar research aims as you, but she says restaurants are particularly inauthentic contexts for human interaction because they are organized to determine mood and behavior. So, in other words, our choice to consume at this restaurant is very much also a product of someone else's choice, and that our experience is decided for us. And so how do we express ourselves individually at restaurants?
I mean, she has a point. I mean, clearly restaurants are designed in such a way that people will behave in a relatively predictable kind of way. They're a setting within which groups of people eating their dinners with their friends or their partner or whatever actually operate. If I remember Finkelstein's argument correctly, I mean, she thought that was a form of kind of or almost deception or manipulation. When I did the first study that probably about 5 years later, we came to the conclusion it's a study I did with Lydia Martins, that this was a rather one-sided view of what happened in restaurants. And what we did was, I think Joanna Finkelstein simply observed in restaurants and speculated about what the meaning of the of the setting was. So it was almost a personal ethnographic information. We went out and asked people. We did a survey of 1,000 people in three cities in England and talked to some of them quite a lot in depth, about 30 something of those. And they didn't tell us things that made us think that the place was, in a sense, doing them any real harm or damage. I mean, one of the things that we find is that people value very highly the sociability and the companionship and the conversation that goes on in restaurants. And I don't think that is particularly determined by the restaurateur. So the restaurateur sets the context. People can then decide whether they want to be in that context. They operate more or less autonomously as a group within the restaurant. Restaurants are very orderly places, I think, because people understand, in a sense, the rules of the game, the rules of behavior. Whether that is something which kind of undermines the authenticity of their interaction or damages their social relationships, we weren't at all clear. Because what we found was that people thought being in restaurants was absolutely wonderful, basically. Mm-hmm. So we asked one of those survey questions, do you like something, you know, a lot, a little, dislike it, whatever? And we asked people about the last time they were in a restaurant eating a main meal, eating a dinner, big dinner. You know, did you like the food? And 90% said they liked the food a lot. Did you like the conversation? 98% of people liked the conversation. Did you like your companions? 95% of them liked them a lot. There was a little bit of less kind of certainty about service. But basically, overall, people think being in restaurants are wonderful because it's a very sociable place to be, and it gives them kind of new tastes. So it has a sensual aspect to it. It's either the food that they're eating. And it's, at least in the UK, one of the most, perhaps the most popular recreational activity. So the idea that that the restaurant is somehow kind of making them passive or damping down their activity or reducing their potential didn't seem to us to be the right overall conclusion to draw.
Yeah, actually, when I read her argument, I took it a slightly different way in maybe the previous step, where we choose restaurants not unlike how we choose Netflix TV shows, where we choose a setting that we want to feel a certain way in. For example, I'm not sure if you're familiar with how Netflix kind of recommends.
I haven't read the book for a long time. I mean, I think people do choose the sort of place where they will feel reasonably comfortable. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that about the changing restaurant world in Britain was that in the 70s and 80s, people might feel rather uncomfortable in some sorts of restaurants, and people largely because they were too formal. Mm. So, you know, I remember that when you were supposed to wear a tie to go to a restaurant, which doesn't happen anymore in Britain. Mm-hmm. And people were a bit scared of the head waiter or the sommelier, and they were a bit uncertain about manners and how to behave. That's pretty much disappeared now, as the places have become more informal and people have got used to going to restaurants. So people in the UK really kind of, there's a change about 50 years ago when people eaten out in restaurants because they had to, because they weren't at home and there was nobody there was no means of getting food other than eating out. But it was not a very important symbolic or cultural activity. People learned to enjoy it in a sort of way. Mm-hmm. And lots more people, the upper middle class always enjoyed it. But it became much more common for everybody, all sorts of people, to go to restaurants. When they didn't know a great deal about it, lots of people were relatively uncomfortable and it was difficult. As it's become a much more familiar experience, which it has done steadily over the last 50 years, people are much more comfortable, much more familiar, mm-hmm. much easier to manage. One of the ways that's been achieved is by going to the sorts of place that is suitable for the occasion that you want to have. So if I'm going to take my parents out for dinner, I will take them to somewhere different from my a family gathering with my children and my brothers and sisters, for instance. And that's sensible, I think. So people are increasingly practically skilled in choosing places which will make the kind of social event that they're concerned about a satisfactory one, one where everybody enjoys themselves. So I don't think that it's quite like, it's not quite like Netflix. I mean, people do like restaurants, or the food in restaurants at least, to challenge them to some significant degree. So when the study I talked to you about, I repeated it again 20 years later. So 2 or 3 years ago, I did the same study again. Lost my train of thought. Kind of gave evidence of the way in which people kind of fit their purposes mm-hmm. to particular settings.
Yeah, if I may so stubbornly persist my Netflix metaphor, it kind of reminds me of you sometimes want to be the person that selects the artful, tasteful documentary on Netflix, but sometimes you also don't have you just happen to default to a certain comedic show that you've watched again and again. And so if we may extend that metaphor and apply that to how we choose restaurants, what does choosing to eat with your parents or someone you want to impress at Noma say about you and your choices versus eating at, you know, the neighborhood restaurant that you know and love and can rely on?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important that people can do both of those things, and they do, or some people do both those things. So lots of people, when we ask them, have you been to the restaurant that you last reported before, most of them say yes. So the majority of people have been to the restaurant before. But if you ask people about do they like to try new foods, have they learnt about food and eating and dishes by going to restaurants? Have they learned things on holidays? A lot of people say yes. And there is one of the key changes of the last 20 years is that people have become more adventurous and more interested in trying, for instance, foreign cuisines. Very, very clear that that's the case. So if I want to impress my professorial friends, I may take them somewhere where the food is exotic or different or whatever. If I go out with my parents, they will probably choose the restaurant. So one of the things about restaurants is that lots of times you end up in restaurants where you haven't done any choosing. So one of the most fascinating questions in the survey in 1995 was, did you have any choice in where you went? And about 40% of people said no. You get taken. Somebody else makes the decision. So the idea that that everybody individually is making endless decisions about which restaurant to go go to simply isn't the way things work. That's not how it's done. You go, in a sense, where you're told to go, or where your friends want you to go, or where you always went for Thanksgiving dinner, or whatever. So there are lots of different kind of scenarios and settings and processes. But on your last question, I mean, do people want to impress other people? Yes, sometimes they do. And people do accumulate experiences of a variety. I mean, a key theme in all the things that we've studied is the value of variety. I mean, restaurants produce a huge diversity of cuisines and atmospheres and settings and forms of service and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And people, ordinary people in the street, want more variety. Mm-hmm. Some people actually get more variety than others do. And that's related to people's resources, to their cultural knowledge and skill, to their social class, to their ethnic group, and various other kinds of things that interest sociologists. Certain kinds of restaurant experience are more highly valued than others. And you mentioned Noma. Mm-hmm. Not everybody gets to go to Noma.
Yeah,
indeed, a large number of people would never want to go to Noma. But it does have some kind of status because it's gastronomically highly valued. And the kinds of people who have the gastronomic knowledge or interest, and indeed also the financial resources, are a particular section of the population. They tend to be in professional and managerial jobs. They have university degrees. They're fairly well off. They have friends who also think that being very interested in food is a good idea. And they also mostly have parents who were professional and managerial workers as well. So they... different groups of people go to different places. But the thing about eating out is you can do it, you know, 3 times a week. I mean, people do it about once every 10 days on average. But you can go to lots of different places and have a wide variety of experiences if you want to. Some people do, some people don't. But there is some kind of social and symbolic significance to having a very wide experience of different sorts of cuisines and activities. And it would seem that one of the other key themes is people want to be comfortable in the restaurants that they go to. They don't want to feel too challenged or whatever. Some people feel comfortable in lots of places, lots of different types of places, and other people feel comfortable in a more limited range of places. What I think now happens is that people go to the sorts of places that they can handle reasonably comfortably because it's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be a nice, it's primarily a nice social activity. Mm-hmm. That's what people really appreciate, the sociability, being with and conversing with your friends and friends and associates. Often I think the food is almost... it's certainly not secondary. Everybody's concerned that the food is both appropriate and of acceptable quality. But in many cases, it's not the most important thing. So if it's not the most important thing, going to your neighborhood in Britain, it would be your neighborhood Italian or your neighborhood Indian restaurant, quite often makes a good deal of sense.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break, but when we get back, I do want to get right back to what you said about those individuals in the dinner parties who actually didn't have a choice in where they ended up eating. So yeah,
okay.
Hang tight.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show until the end of March 2019. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Make sure you check out Chow while you still can. The exhibition closes at the end of March 2019. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Jimmy Carboni, and I'm the host of Beer Sessions Radio here on HRN. My show is an audio ale salon celebrating the world of craft beer, cider, food, and more. Through discussions with industry insiders and knowledgeable beer fans, my friends and I explore every aspect of the brewer's craft, from grains to pint glass and tasting to toasting. You can find Beer Sessions Radio wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back. So we were talking about the our choice to go to certain restaurants because they make us feel comfortable. And I want to talk about kind of the unspoken etiquette that happens at a restaurant. Namely, when you are eating in a big group of people and you are not the one that chose the restaurant. And you mentioned this, which I thought was really funny. You're not really allowed to complain about the choice of restaurant. So can you explain why and I guess the mental process that goes behind this?
Obviously, it depends upon... I mean, if you've been invited to a restaurant and you've accepted the invitation, you tend to not want to tell your host or your hostess that they've made a rotten choice. It would be both rude and probably kind of damage your friendship or your relationship. It's interesting that people don't like complaining. So when you ask a question in a survey, would you complain if the food was bad or whatever? Lots of people say yes. And then when you talk to them about their actual experiences, they give you all sorts of reasons why they wouldn't actually complain. And mostly it's because it upsets the nature of the interaction around the table. If you start kind of complaining to the staff, the atmosphere changes. It's no longer a convivial, friendly, amusing kind of activity. It adds a kind of bite and an edge to it. And people are kind of loathe to complain. And sometimes in interviews, they describe, you know, the food was too salty. 15 minutes longer for my dinner to arrive, and my dining companion's dinner to arrive. The food wasn't very nice, but actually we enjoyed the occasion altogether, so we didn't complain. So people are a bit embarrassed about complaining, but they're probably more concerned with what it does to the atmosphere around the table. I mean, we also get people in interviews saying, I hate going out with my sister-in-law because she always complains and it makes the event a kind of miserable and edgy kind of activity.
Mm-hmm. There's also...
But particularly if you're the guest, you're unlikely to want to challenge your host's or hostess's judgment. And indeed, it's actually... thought of that it's the responsibility of the person who's in charge of the table, so to speak, to do the complaining. So mm-hmm. If they don't want to complain, you can't complain over their heads. Is part of what people tell me is mm-hmm. the etiquette. Yeah, that's what you wanted to know?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I was about to mention. I thought it was really neat to hear someone validate that there is someone that's been established as the leader of the group, and you kind of all default to that person because they picked that restaurant, and it's only okay to complain once that person complains.
Yes, I think that I think that's right. I mean, our studies were interested in people's in domestic hospitality, in dinner parties and kind of meals that people provide in their own homes for their friends and for other people, other kin who don't live in the same place. There used to be a very strong understanding that the event was orchestrated and run by the host and hostess who provided the food, and you certainly wouldn't complain I have never complained to anybody who's invited me out for dinner about the quality of their cooking or the way they've organized the dinner. And there is eating in restaurants has some kind of echo or relationship to much longer traditions of what is hospitality and who's hosts and guests. To some extent, I think the norms and conventions of the dinner party are observed in restaurants. It may depend upon who's paying, and it may depend upon who's made the decision to go in the first place. Because sometimes it's a collective decision. Lots of people go to the same place with the same friends many times. Then presumably anybody can complain. So it does depend a bit on the setting and on the social relationships between the people who are, in a sense, at the table. Mm-hmm. And they will vary quite a lot from situation to situation.
So you also talk about variety and choice and about our shifting line between what's necessary versus a luxury. And I think this also ties into what quote-unquote ethnic restaurants have made into the mainstream. So first, let's talk about this differentiation between necessities and luxuries and what this exactly means for our future of food.
When I do that, I sort of think, you know, eating is necessary. It has to be done in some kind of minimal way to satisfy health. The cultural alternatives for ways in which we can have such a diet or obtain the kind of foods that are contribute to our dietary intake over, you know, a year or 12 months are really enormous variety. So the necessity is a kind of biological one. Whether we eat in a kind of abstemious and frugal kind of way, or whether we go for caviar and truffles, is in a sense a kind of group and cultural matter. Different people would do that in a different kind of way. I mean, usually what the term luxury is a relative one. What was a luxury in the 16th century is now commonplace. I like to think of asking people what they think are necessary and what is luxury, and the view of that would change from country to country and from period to period. Mm-hmm. We've got used to kind of more elaborate and more varied food, I think, in the period since the Second World War. So what's a luxury becomes, I mean, luxuries are always somewhat rare and somewhat expensive. So what they might be at any one point in time or in any particular place is just relative to what would be a very kind of ordinary or minimal kind of diet. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think luxuries are anyway.
So what does choosing these rare or expensive foods convey about the person in the same way that being varied, versed, or nimble among different cultures, cuisines, what do those two things signify about the person?
I mean, I think that's an important point. Some people, in our most recent study, we find about 10% of the people who answered the survey would correspond to kind of a group of food enthusiasts, foodies, and might be an unfair term, but people who are really concerned about the food that they eat, they're deeply interested in it, they buy from specialist food shops rather than from supermarkets, they go out to restaurants a lot, they entertain people a lot, they say they like cooking, they take a great deal of interest and time and concern, and they talk about food in a very knowledgeable kind of way. And they value things that other people, that the mass of the population probably would neither want nor be very interested in trying. There are two aspects to that, I think. One is that just some people are interested in food. A really small number of people are very interested in food as a matter of aesthetics, of gastronomy, of kind of cultural competence, of knowledge. And they like to talk about food, and they're very knowledgeable about it. Most people aren't like that. The people who are food enthusiasts, on the other hand, tend to be people with, as I said before, university degrees in professional occupations, with parents who were also in professional occupations. And it's quite difficult to tell whether what they're doing is making a social statement about their position in the world, or whether they're just being very enthusiastic about a particular activity. So instead of being an opera buff or going to the cinema three times a week and being an expert in film, they're just experts in food. Or is it a statement about a special form of knowledge, capacity for judgment, a knowledge of international cuisine, of a cosmopolitan approach to their activity more generally? And what other bits of research tend to suggest is that people who are this foodie group is likely also to have a kind of varied tastes in cinema and music and the visual arts and so on. So there is a form of kind of cultural capacity, cultural competence, which is exhibited in the field of food, which is also exhibited in other cultural contexts, and which can easily be read as a statement about the status of those people, mm-hmm. that they are knowledgeable and confident and capable.
Yeah, I think it also seems a bit odd then that things like Soylent or nutrition bars, or even just pills that replace your meal, are also very popular. And can you explain how those two can coexist?
Those sorts of things coexist because there are lots and lots of different ways in which you can kind of satisfy nutritional capacities. I'd be surprised if the people who go to Noma eat a lot of... nutrition bars. The thing is, you can do both things at once. I doubt whether eating nutrition bars is highly symbolic. It might be symbolic within certain sorts of subgroups, possibly. But I can eat those and I can go to Noma. There's no contradiction in that regard. And there's some sense in which people who are very interested in food will try almost anything and everything. How long they continue to do the various alternative ways of eating, that's a different matter. But I don't think there's any real contradiction between eating nutrition pills sometimes and going to smart restaurants on other occasions. Mm. I don't think the people who go to smart restaurants would eat pills all the time and give up the restaurant. Mm.
I think maybe it's less a comment on intellect and maybe more a comment on economics or social class. Maybe it's like a way of signifying I can afford to eat an acai bowl or a pill and in very nice looking packaging in the same way that I would choose to spend my money on a Noma meal. And I guess I was just interested to hear your thoughts on how we use those choices to convey something to our peers.
One can use the things that become symbolic in relation to being either, in this that case, maybe a good citizen or being at the head of a trend in food consumption. Mm. They can be very, very different, very variable. It's over long periods of time, the things that are symbolically visible tend to persist over time longer than some kind of maybe fashions for particular kinds of products. I wouldn't like to predict anything. Sociologists aren't very good at predicting what the future of those nutrition bars might be. Mm-hmm. But they probably have a limited lifetime as a symbolic expression of what sort of a kind of group identity you might happen to espouse.
Mm-hmm. On that note, I think we're going to end the conversation there. That was a really ironic and kind of depressing note, but I think that's perfect. Thank you so much for joining me today, Alan.
Okay, thanks. Nice to talk to you. Okay, goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.